ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 7, Text 26. Trinavartah, Trinavarta Shantarayo, Trinavarta Shantarayo, Vatyarupadharoharan, Krishnam Nabhogato Gantum, Krishnam Nabhogato Gantum, Nashaknod Bhuribharabhrit, Nashaknod Bhuribharabhrit. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation. Having assumed the form of a forceful whirlwind, the demon Trinavarta took Krishna very high in the sky. But when Krishna became heavier than the demon had to stop his force and could go no further. Purport. Here is a competition in yogic power between Krishna and Trinavarta. By practicing mystic yoga, asuras generally attain some perfection in the eight siddhis or perfections, namely anima, laghima, mahima, prapti, prakamya, ishitva, vashitva, and kama vasaita. But although a demon may acquire such powers to a very limited extent, he cannot compete with the mystic power of Krishna, for Krishna is Yogeshwara, the source of all mystic power. Yatra Yogeshwaro Hari. No one can compete with Krishna. Sometimes, of course, having acquired a fragmental portion of Krishna's mystic power, asuras demonstrate their power to the foolish public and assert themselves to be God, not knowing that God is the supreme Yogeshwara. Here also we see that Trinavarta assumed the Mahima Siddhi and took Krishna away as if Krishna were an ordinary child. But Krishna also became a mystic Mahima Siddha. When Mother Yashoda was carrying him, he became so heavy that his mother, who was usually accustomed to carrying him, could not bear him and had to place him down on the ground. Thus, Trinavarta had been able to take Krishna away in the presence of Mother Yashoda. But when Krishna, high in the sky, assumed the Mahima Siddhi, the demon, unable to go further, was obliged to stop his force and come down according to Krishna's desire. One should not, therefore, compete with Krishna's mystic power. Devotees automatically have all mystic power, but they do not like to compete with Krishna. Instead, they fully surrender to Krishna and their yogic power is demonstrated by Krishna's mercy. Devotees can show mystic power so powerful that a demon could not even dream of it, but they never try to demonstrate it for their personal sense gratification. Whatever they do is for the service of the Lord, and therefore they are always in a position superior to that of the demons. There are many karmis, yogis and jnanis who artificially try to compete with Krishna, and thus ordinary foolish people who do not care to hear Srimad Bhagavatam from authorities consider some rascal yogi to be Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At the present moment, there are many so-called babas who present themselves as incarnations of God by showing some insignificant mystic wonder, and foolish people regard them as God because of lacking knowledge of Krishna. Every demon who came to kill Krishna in Braja had a specific siddhi, a specific power, and he was Vatya Rupa Dhara. Vat is wind. Just like Agasur became a big snake. But while living in Mathura, he was living like a so-called gentleman, having his own palace, chariots, servants, opulence. All these persons since their king was Kamsa, one of the most inimical toward Krishna, therefore all the powerful people were almost to some extent as much inimical towards Krishna as Kamsa. So Bakasur, Vyamasur, Agasur, in their daily life, they would be just like two arms, two legs, nice face, and enjoying material comforts. But when we see them in the episode where they meet Krishna, there is some kind of a link as to the thought process of each progressive demon. It's not like a set rule, but like Agasur, Bakasur and Putana are from the same family. You can understand what a family it is. Two brothers and a sister and so much in envy of Krishna. So they come to know of Krishna killing Putana, and then their envy becomes more. It is also pointed out by the Acharyas that how is Shamsundar Krishna, one who stays in Vrindavan, how is he superior? There is one kind of superiority where you show your brute force through arms, weapons, equipment, and there is a superior force exhibited when you do the needful without having any weapons. So if somebody has a pistol or a revolver which can shoot 6 bullets, and somebody has which has capacity for 60, so one which has capacity for 60 is said to be superior. Like the bombs, countries began competing with against each other. But what if somebody shoots, not necessarily shoots, but somebody kills you by just saying something, you die, and that fellow drops down dead. This is supposed to be superior to even a weapon, right? Like in my school and college days, there was, I think it comes in the life of every youngster, you are attracted towards martial arts. Sometime or other, you get this sudden feeling that one should learn martial arts. And you watch all these posters where they show demonstrations, they break bricks with their bare hands or with their forehead even. So, karate or jiu-jitsu also gains popularity because of this attraction that you don't need any stick, you don't need any weapon, you can just fight with your arms, like defense and also offense. So Vishnu has two symbols which are used against demons, the disc chakra and the gada kamodaki. In Braja, Krishna doesn't use any weapon. That's his specialty. Read each and every leela scrutinizingly and you'll find that beginning from Putana, what was the weapon used against Putana? His lips. Now the lips can't be said to be weapons. With Keshi, it was just his fist. Bakasur, his arms. With Trinavarta, his weight. He didn't do anything. He didn't threaten him. He didn't say that, okay, you come down and then we'll see. No. So none of the demons killed in Vrindavan were subjected to the treatment of any weapon or any astra, shastra, whatever. And the acharyas assert that this is how Krishna shows that. Of course, later when Krishna becomes Dwarkadish, he carries weapons, armor, and everything, just like befitting a normal king. So he had assumed the form of a forceful whirlwind, Vatya Rupa Dharo, and Haran. He could actually take away Krishna from the midst of the coward community. This aspect is also highlighted by the acharyas, those who expertly understand a particular incident. How is it that Krishna can be taken away from the midst of devotees? Like when Lord Chaitanya was visiting South India, he came across a devotee of Lord Ram who was immersed in Ramayana so much that after having a nice discussion, Mahaprabhu inquired, this person is a mendicant, he's a Brahmana devotee. So he said, is there any arrangement for bhojan? So his answer was, Lakshman has gone out and he will get some herbs and roots, fruits, whatever. So as soon as he makes arrangement, we will take the prasad. So Mahaprabhu was very impressed that this person, although living now, millions of years after this lila has taken place, still in his mind is serving Lord Ram by remembering the pastimes. And there in that episode, this description is given as to this question, how can a rascal like Ravana touch Mother Sita? What to speak of taking her away? So then the Puranic evidence is given that it's not possible. People like Ravana can never touch. They can never conceive of the internal potency, what to speak of having the satisfaction that for some time at least I have the potency with me. Many times the demonic tendency is, I know I'm going to die. I know that. In fact, sometimes demons assert, I don't fear death. While as aspiring devotees, we feel, well, it's not like I don't fear death, I do fear death. Although I am not this body, I do fear. I cannot claim to be completely free from the bodily conception of life. While demonic people may say, you will die one day. So what? Now, have they conquered death? Have they conquered fear? Wait and watch. That's what we have to do. Many times, foolishness, plain ignorance can also play a big role. We just are not aware of what happens to you after you die. So one of the main points of Prabhupada's lectures in the West, that very nicely Western civilization has convinced itself there is no life after death. The whole show is finished. And in fact, this is not a new thing either. Lord Krishna has given hints of it in the Bhagavad Gita that these demoniac personalities, asha pasha shatair baddha, asha, desires, aspiration to enjoy this world, shatair, hundreds of them, pralayanta, till the time of death they have that. And if you ask them what this world is for, kim manyat kama hetukam, it's all lust. You see lust everywhere. That's what this world is for. So try to satisfy your lust and die anyway. Eat right, stay fit, and die anyway. eat the right kind of food. Of course, what is the right kind of food also is a big question. But eat the right kind of food. Stay fit. Jog, swim, go to the gym or whatever, and die anyway. By belittling death, by calling death, like some of the romantic poets, they get in that kind of mood, and they might see some mundane love or some mundane affection, and they say, "Death, don't thou touch this. This love is immortal." It's a fanciful dream that you want something which death cannot touch. So the fear of death is real. And death cannot be conquered just by belittling it, just by criticizing it. Or if you are saying, "I don't fear death." Prabhupada tells some Bengali stories about a sculptor who made 9 forms of himself, 9 wax murtis of himself, in the hope that if the Yamadutas come, they might get confused as to which is the real one. And he was a very talented person. So he made these murtis, and he could fool the Yamadutas maybe. But Yamaraj took special interest in this case. Here is someone trying to hoodwink my authority. So he looked at them, they were in a particular courtyard, and he very scrutinizing, looking at every murti. And what is the ego of an artist? That my creation is flawless. So just to test how much metal this particular artist has, Yamaraj saw the real man. The real man also was standing in a pose like that. And the other murtis also were there. And he said, "This particular ear is out of proportion. I mean, everything is nice, but this particular, it looks a little bit asymmetrical." And this fellow, he should have just stayed still. But no, the ego just came up and he said, "Hey, there is no fault here." He caught him. Another person put his stool all over his body. Another brain wave, you get that if I do like this, they won't touch me. So stool is untouchable. How can you catch somebody who has put his own stool over? But still, they took him away. Of course, these are folk stories, and Prabhupada used the essence of that, that not by becoming too smart, not by becoming too dull, or too ignorant, or too degraded, too debased, that you can hoodwink death. It's not possible. Like in our school and college life, we saw 2 categories of students who would say, there's no fear of exam. Like there is one class who from day one are always studying. I happen to be with one such group. And the only thing they would discuss is exams. Syllabus, exams, syllabus, exams. So I would have a strategy. At the right time, I would take their association. Like, who wants to talk of exams in June and July when the semester has begun? But by the time it is August and September, October, then you should go with the studious class, you know, so that you, at least you come to know what's in the portion and what's important, what's not important. And there is another class who also never fear exams, who are like the permanent members of the College Education Trust, you know, unless they are removed from the college by some special extraordinary general meeting, they have no desire to leave it. Similarly, in life, those who are pure devotees, like what was Prabhupada's reaction when a sannyasi came after a long preaching tour and he was amazed to see Prabhupada's body become so emaciated? He said, I can't bear to see you like this. Because maybe for 6-7 years only, from 10 years, 65 to 75, or 66 to 76, he has seen Prabhupada. But at least Prabhupada looked a bit sprightly, youthful. Youthful at age 75, youthful at age 76. But he would walk with a fast pace and everything. But then to see Prabhupada like that, he said, I can't bear to see you like this. And even in that condition, Prabhupada uttered, don't think this will not happen to you. Because Prabhupada, by so-called appearance of material laws, his body was giving that kind of appearance. But he knew that every one of his followers, for them it would be like, read the syllabus, but one day it's going to be an exam time. So, all these demons, it's not like because they had conquered the fear of death that they went and attacked Krishna. No way. They were just greedy for the emoluments, for the boons which Kamsa would give them. They were angry at what Krishna did to some of their friends or other relatives. They were afraid of Kamsa for what he would do. So fear of someone is there. They didn't have fear of Krishna that, oh no, he could kill me. Because Krishna had assumed the form of a coward boy or a baby. He's not even a grown-up boy. So the question, how can Krishna be taken away from the midst of devotees? Like, how can someone lose his or her Krishna consciousness? If I can just make it a kind of a occurrence in our sadhana. Number one, within the group of pure devotees, only when Krishna wills, like here this time, Prabhupada says here, Yashoda Mai was carrying Krishna every day practically, all the time. So if she is carrying him, how can Krishna allow Trinavarta to come and also harm his own mother? He would never allow that. So Krishna expands his siddhis and becomes so heavy that his own mother was wondering, how come suddenly he became so heavy? And she puts him down. Now this is Krishna's wish, because he knows Trinavarta is going to come. And then she is busy with other household duties. Now if Krishna is heavy like a mountain, and if Trinavarta cannot lift him, he might leave. So one moment Krishna is heavy, the next moment Krishna is not. The next moment Krishna is again heavy, the next moment is not. Now this is siddhi. Sometimes there are siddhis which you do something and you can't undo it. Is it not? Those who work with computers, you find a rapidly working thing, latest technology, it can't go back. So that means it is not under your full control. It gave you the appearance that it's under your control. But here we find, not heavy with Mother Yashoda. Heavy with Mother Yashoda, then light for Trinavarta. Again heavy for Trinavarta, and again normal. Krishnam nabho gato gantum. And since Trinavarta is a whirlwind, where's the fun if he has just taken Krishna, say, one or two stories high and then he just brings him down? Obviously, we also won't feel Trinavarta is really dead. So nabho gato, the desire of anybody who's like a personified whirlwind, is to take him so high up. Our BBT artists have perfectly captured this particular leela, where you see the whole of Braja like a very small hamlet of villages dotted by some trees. Of course, the acharyas say that Just like we also sometimes like to have a look, a view of certain places at ground level, little bit high level, and then from a very high level, like obviously it's human nature, just think about it. So many times books are released by photographers of say monuments or temples by only using aerial photography. Recently, a politician, he released a book on Pandharpur, which is only filled with, mainly filled with aerial photographs. And that's his expertise. So, seeing through his vision, readers sort of, oh, just see how it looks. So when Krishna wants to have a big aerial view of Vrindavan, I mean, he cannot climb a tree, he's still a baby. But he uses a demon who goes high up. Krishna enjoys the view. And it's okay now. My job's done. Na ashakdod. Now Trinamata finds it very difficult. He cannot, na ashakdod, he cannot carry him. Why? Bhuri bhara bhrit. Krishna has become so heavy, was not able, because Krishna then became more powerful. Prabhupada uses for bhar. Bhar mainly is weight. But here Prabhupada is saying, more powerful and heavy than the demon. One of the themes which I gather from Prabhupada's purport is competition. Competition with Krishna. One of my favorite things which I was very attracted to is this simple dialogue in Perfect Question, Perfect Answer, where Bob Cohen, later becoming Brahmatirtha Prabhu, he asks Prabhupada that what's wrong with having a simple ambition of having a job, some wealth, money, wife, children, husband. Like, you're not competing with God. Your first query, if you ask someone that, who is God? What does he look like? What kind of resources he has? Oh, he's the richest, he's the most opulent. Now, when I say, I do not have any ambition of competing with the Ambanis. So somebody might say, how dare you even think of that? I mean, how much you have? Well, a couple of lakhs, a cycle, a one-room flat in Borivali, 6-7 shirts, trousers. I mean, it sounds abnormally ludicrous for someone like me to say, and I'm not competing with them. And people say, I know we are not competing with them. You check out with someone your size. So you might say to your fellow neighbor in your one-room BHK, two-BHK, whatever flat, and say, look, I'm not competing with you. Now that depends on whether he's really convinced or not. But if you go and tell someone like the Ambani that, look, Mr. Mukesh, I'm not competing with you, he might not even notice you. He says, who are you? So many times we have this question that Prabhupada sitting on a Vyasasana is telling us, don't compete with Krishna. We may say, like somebody in the West may say, I never even knew he existed. What to speak of competing with him? So in that simple conversation, Brahmatirtha Prabhu is saying, Bob Cohen is saying that, is it bad to have an ambition that, you know, some family life, some money on the side, a little bit extra just for some miscellaneous expenditure? I mean, what's the problem with that? Prabhupada, like a scrutinizingly accurate person, he says, but whose money is it that you want? Now, this is a question which nobody has taught us the real answer. Whose money is that what we want in life? Ask any businessman. So you may say, whose money? It's like the sea water.
For some time it is just available. When I take it and keep it at home, it's my water. Is it not? Knowledge is outside there. I go and learn something, it's my knowledge. Like how to beat the stock market. Some kind of theories always are floating around. But if you decide to do something, you write a book and then you patent it. You say, hey, this is my theory, nobody can use it. What is the thing called patenting? We are using things which are available and claiming that these are mine. So Prabhupada says, well, that small money which you are saying, if I could get it, I'll be very happy. It already belongs to Krishna. That's the problem. So if you say, is there anything in this world which doesn't belong to Krishna, so that, you know, like these geographical explorers, they always have this thing, virgin territory. That means nobody has claimed it yet. Christopher Columbus, when he was sent by the Queen, he said, just discover a new world for us. What do you mean new world? He already found people, tribes, living there for centuries. So he puts a flag there saying, I claim this land in the name of my queen. They were saying, which queen and what kind of thing is this? Columbus Day, still celebrated in America. The day he came and he claimed that entire land for his queen. This is the absurdity. There is not a single speck of dust anywhere within the 14 worlds which is not created by Krishna. There is simply no scope. So therefore, the moment we say, I want something, little fame, knowledge, power, beauty, opulence, or renunciation, it already has a proprietor. And therefore, we agree that coveting somebody else's property is enviousness. Right? We agree with that. If I see your money in your pocket and I say, I want that, I may say, hey, be civil. Don't be a criminal kind of person. But when you see money lying in the street, you may say, there is no proprietor here. Is it not? So this is what Prabhupada in that small passage was trying exactly to communicate. That this world is made in such a way that the proprietorship is not evident. You don't find in the sky some kind of sign saying, this property belongs to Mr. So-and-so and trespassers will be prosecuted. No. We don't find the Himalayas having any kind of thing. Nowhere. But man does. A small road, this belongs to so-and-so. This factory belongs to so-and-so. These are the papers. So the root of sin, Prabhupada writes in the Ishopanishad, the root of sin is deliberate disobedience to the laws of nature. How do you show your deliberate disobedience? By disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord. So the first lesson for an aspiring devotee is nothing's mine. You may say, all right, nothing's mine. That's incomplete. Everything is Krishna's. So competition is like ingrained in us. And here Prabhupada is saying, don't compete with Krishna unnecessarily. I'll end with a small incident, chapter 66 of the 10th canto, where unbelievably, I was thinking, I mean, I've read it before, but now think of this kind of, this particular light, that this could happen today. You know that somebody can have actually Kaustubha thing on his chest and a mukut, and two styrofoam arms on his back, wearing yellow silk. Amazingly, while Krishna was sitting in his palace in Dwarka, a person came and requested audience, and Krishna allowed. Okay, let him come in. He says, I am the servant of the Lord of the Karushas, and my Lord is requesting you to please understand a particular message from him. He says, yeah, what is it? The message read, I am the real Vasudev and you are an imposter. Please give up your symbols. Accept my sovereignty. And Shukadev Goswami is an alert narrator. He himself is getting the taste of narration. With Krishna's narration, it's not like only the person who's hearing gets the taste. Shrotram, Vaktra, Pritchakam, all three. So Shukadev Goswami mentions this thing twice, that someone can come before Krishna and say, you are the bogus Krishna and I am the real Vasudev. So Vishwanatha Chakravarti says, Shukadev Goswami was so amazed at somebody's foolishness. You know, like sometimes when he hears something and we ask twice, you sure he went there? He went there, really? So it's like, just to reinforce. So first of all the Dwarka members of the Senate, the ministers and everybody, normally you come, although it's Krishna, still it is administration work, you know, accounts and borders and defenses. And they had a hearty laugh. Like early morning, the first thing on the agenda is this kind of a person coming and giving this kind of message. So they laughed heartily. It was like a breather, it was like a big stress reliever. And the last point of the message was, come and meet me in the battle and give up all your symbols. So Krishna says, all right, I'll meet him in battle. And as he went, Krishna also set with a small army. Now Krishna's in Dwarka. This fellow was staying with his friends in his friend's palace in Kashi. But they met. There, this particular Poundrak, that was his name, and his friend Kashi Raj, they both came out with two Akshohini armies. And there was a big war, big battle. Of course, it's a big battle doesn't mean that Krishna had to really exert his force or really had to, you know, it was like, oh, hard work. But you maintain such an army, you have to give them some work also. And then Krishna came before him and said, I think you wanted something from me. You said I should release my symbols. Before that, again Krishna saw him, and the acharyas mentioned this was the first time actually Krishna saw Poundrak. Before you had not even seen him anywhere. And he saw that actually he has put two false arms, you know, like styrofoam or foam kind of polyurethane, any kind of things we make now. Fiber, all our dioramas made from fiber, something like that. And he had copied everything exactly. He had asked some really knowledgeable people as to how Krishna looks like. So the proper dress, the mukut, the Srivatsa chinna, the Kaustubha mani. He was slightly inconvenienced moving around because Prabhupada mentions the very reason why he was doing that. He was falsely praised by foolish people. That's the surest way to think you're God. When you get the admiration of foolish people, ignorant people. So finally, laughing at Dwarka once, laughing in the battlefield twice, Krishna says to himself, it's enough now. So he says, okay, here is the disc. Handle this first. And the disc goes tsk, 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 chops off his neck. And that's the end of this charade of trying to imitate. So, of course, it's a long story. Then that friend of his also, he also gets his neck chopped. And he had boasted to his people that we are going to battle and I am going to come back with Krishna's head. That's all. And suddenly a big thud occurs in the palace courtyard, and they see somebody's chopped head has fallen there. So the queens and the people think that maybe our king has been successful and he has chopped Krishna's head. And they go there, to their horror, they find it is their own king. Now at least this should have stopped the enmity, but no. The sinful queens and his son, he decides to do a big Homa Yajna for Lord Shiva. He invokes another spirit, a big demon, fiery demon made from fire. And he says, go and kill Krishna. So the gist of the story is, of course, then he goes to Krishna and then can't do anything before Krishna. So he comes back. Now with this kind of jadu tona, ghori thing, you release it at someone, and if that person is powerful or Krishna is protecting him, that same impact goes back on you. So this urge, or rather this sinful trait to compete with Krishna, is at the root of all maladies, all problems. We can see how much we are in the mode of competition when we actually glorify competition. We see in this world, people feel that the best comes out when you are in a competing mode. Is it not? At least I had done the foolishness of asking my college professor. I said, in the corporate world, people have to compete so much. He said, yes. Then you get the best out of them. So I said, but what if we cooperate? As if he got a shock or something, he said, what? I said, is it a possibility that within a team or companies can cooperate with each other? He told me, you're not fit for being an MBA. I mean, I had not realized that. Now, of course, I have. But the very notion that he got angry by thinking cooperation. I mean, the basic thing in economics is desires are unlimited, resources are limited. That's it. And here is Prabhupada, who says, curb those unlimited material desires. And if you come to spiritual life, resources are unlimited. How about that for spiritual economics? These acharyas, they work under this kind of a understanding. Actually, it is Giriraj Maharaj. I eternally am indebted to him for giving this nice clarification. While doing devotional service, he says, devotees should always understand that if you see somebody actually excelling in some kind of devotional service, and you also happen to have that desire, he says, please understand, Krishna's capacity to enjoy is unlimited. If somebody has made a garland which is very beautiful, and you also would like to make a garland, somebody has cooked something beautiful, you also like to cook that, Krishna's capacity to enjoy is unlimited. Also, Krishna's desire to enjoy is unlimited. And the third and most important thing, the resources which will enable you to satisfy Krishna's desire are also unlimited. But they are only available to those who are non-envious in heart, who don't want to compete with Krishna. The demons do. So competing with Krishna is like really, really exerting your intelligence, going so high and then crashing down. This is what we see in the life of Trinavarta. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Thank you very much.